going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices and give you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today. Instacart is on a mission to have you not leave the couch this basketball season. Because between the pregame rituals and the postgame interviews, it can be difficult to find time for everything else. So let Instacart take care of your game day snacks or weekly restocks. And get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Because we hear it's bad luck to be hungry on game day. So download the Instacart app today and enjoy $0 delivery fees on your first 3 orders. Service fees apply for 3 orders in 14 days. Excludes restaurants.
Wednesday, April 23rd. And look, I hardly had to be Nostradamus to predict that it was going to turn hot and humid because it does every year around this time, right? Well, highs near 90 by the end of the week. So get ready for that. Chance for showers today, highs of 83. Then tomorrow for the Zurich Classic, first day of real competition. And also the first day of Jazz Fest, dry, highs of 83. And then near 90 for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So hydrate and sunscreen and all that stuff. Right now it's 70 and the windows are foggy from the air conditioner. So that tells you everything you need to know. Walter Dublane joins us now, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. How you doing, Dub?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Great.
Let's talk about the economy and tariffs. They got a new Gallup poll out, says 53% of Americans say their financial situation is getting worse. First time in 25 years, the majority has expressed financial pessimism. It's hard for me to weigh in on this because I make the same amount of money. I'm blessed. I do all right. And I buy the same amount of stuff. And I'm at that point in life where I don't spend a lot of money. So what is the situation on the economy, Dub? How do you even go about gauging it, people like yourself?
Well, I think what you're seeing in that poll is people are looking at their 401ks or 403bs, and they're seeing that the stock market has fallen 9%, and therefore the value of their retirement looks like it's going down. I think that's probably what's driving that particular poll, because the stock market is, well, again, Wall Street Journal said that the stock market's now falling about, in, it had the worst April since the Great Depression. Now, it picked back up yesterday because Trump had said some things about backing off on maybe we'll get a deal with China. And he also said that he won't fire the head of the Federal Reserve, which was scared, I think, everybody in the world when he said that. And so, and he saw what the reaction to that was. And so I think he's backed down for one of the first times. He's also, he's got Vance over in India, trying to work out a deal with them. So we're possibly seeing some possibilities of backing down on some of these tariffs.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, and I'm not, I just won't lead the politics out of this. I'm just looking at bottom line, right, on a balance sheet. What happened with tariffs? Did anything happen? Did we gain anything, or did the stock market just lose all of that value for nothing?
Well, no. I mean, well, we're not there yet. I mean, the question is, where are we going to be in 6 months or a year from now? And that's what people are, affecting the stock market is what's going to be happening. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we certainly gained nothing yet from the tariffs. But the question is, is he using this as a negotiating tool and trying to get better trade relations with some of the other countries? And if he gets that, he'll back down, like he's talking to with India in particular. And if all that happens, then I think you'll see the stock market go back up, and maybe we will have gained something.
So that's why I'm wondering.
Everybody says but we don't know if that's going to happen, if that's what's going on. But there's at least some, the stock market jumped up because of some hope that that might be happening.
So what's going on with inflation?
Well, of course, the tariffs themselves will cause at least short-term inflation. Now, those haven't really hit yet. I mean, our inflation rate is actually looking still pretty good right now. But the other thing about inflation is, I mentioned Trump was unhappy with Jerome Powell, the head of the Federal Reserve, who kind of does more to control inflation than anybody else. And, you know, people got to remember that most people aren't as old as me, don't remember the last bout of inflation we had in the 1970s. But we need to remember that we haven't had any since the 1970s significantly until this pandemic thing that just happened. Mm-hmm. And that's because the Federal Reserve has controlled it. And so that's why the whole world, when he said, he wants to, fire Jerome Powell because he's not lowering interest rates, that scared everybody because the Fed has done a good job of controlling inflation. Now, what happened since the pandemic was just a confluence of events. It was the Ukraine war. It was driving up oil prices. And then we had all the people coming out of the pandemic, spending money like crazy that they hadn't spent for 2 years. And then the federal government pouring money into the economy. That's what caused this current bout of inflation. But it was a series of things. But the Fed has about got it back under control again until the tariffs story started. And now we're worried about it again.
So let me ask you this, Dob, from the layman can be here, when it comes to these tariffs, at some point there has to be somebody that either has a computer or a big book with keeping track of what's tariffed and what's not and who collects what, when, where, and how. Did anybody get tariffed for anything, or was there anything postponed, or was all of this just a lot of talk? I'm trying to get a handle on this.
Well, the tariffs have started, okay? This 10% across-the-board tariff, he declared a 90-day pause on a number of the tariffs. I know it's really confusing.
Because somebody's got to keep track of this, right, eventually?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, all the people at the borders that collect the tariffs know on any given day what the tariffs are. And the people in the industry, I was talking to my daughter who works with basically the wonderful company and producing pistachios all over the world. Mm-hmm. And she's
really
talking about how complicated it has become getting her pistachios into Canada and into China. And it's on a day-to-day basis of trying to just keep track of what's affecting them. So the people that are actually dealing with it are watching what tariffs affect me. So they've got to know. But the question is, what are they going to be today? What are they going to be tomorrow? And that's the part that nobody really knows. Is he going to back down, or is he going to up again? And, he said he's now saying nice things about China. He got 145% tariffs on China. But now they're saying, maybe we can work out a deal. And so who knows?
Dub,
let
me ask you this personally. As a father, are you okay with your daughter selling out to Big Pistachio? I'm just kidding. I'm just making a joke.
No, she's done that.
Good for her.
She's done great.
Good for her. Absolutely. That's great. Yeah.
I liked it better when she worked for Russell Stover and used to send me chocolates.
Do you get free pistachios or not?
I do get some.
Good for you.
Often, so.
All right. Walter Dove Lane, our guest, associate professor of economics, finance at UNO, my alma mater. How's the economy working out for you? Because I'm trying to understand this. I really am. And I'm trying to take a snapshot or see the market lost a lot of value, or did it really? Do you have to gauge that over time? And we'll pick it up when we come back. And what effect do tariffs have? Because it seems like we've had a lot of talk. The market's lost a lot of value, but I don't know that we've really accomplished anything yet, but maybe it's too early to tell. I don't know. What are you seeing, y'all, at 504-260-1870? Are you, when you go to the store, is your grocery bill going down, going up? Are you doing any better, worse off, better off, same thing? What? Tell me. Because I buy the same stuff over and over. I buy brown rice and chicken, so there you go. Walter Dove Lane, our guest, back in a flash, 621 traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Walter Dove Lane, associate professor of economics and finance at UNO, trying to get a handle on the economy. Dub, I've been getting texts, pardon me, from these spam texts about all of a sudden the market's crashing, invest in gold and so forth, and I never did quite understand the philosophy behind investing in gold, because if everything collapses, I don't know. First of all, if you think they're going to send you the gold, like you see these apocalyptic movies, if you think they're going to send the gold from Switzerland to your house, they're not going to do it, I don't think, if the world economy collapses. And if you actually own it and have it there at your home, what do you do? Take it and shave off a couple of pieces and get a loaf of bread? But between you and the store, there's going to be guys that are going to take it from you. So I don't quite understand that. What am I missing with gold?
Well, it's just the perception. That, you know, gold is viewed as always have been the one thing that will hold its value. And if the stock market crashed, that's why we're seeing gold is up. Everything else is down, but gold has been up. Mm-hmm. And because people think that will always have its value, no matter what happens. If the U.S. currency goes down the tubes, which it's actually heading right now, so the U.S. dollar is actually softened, which is another issue, right, recently, but weakened. But that's just a perception. Now, the actuality of what could you actually do with it? I don't know if people even thought that far ahead. But they just assume that if the world goes to heck and they have gold, that they have at least something that everybody will value.
It sounds good, but the biggest, baddest SOB is good. Take it from you when you're trying to get to the store with it, presuming there is a store. And again, if somebody in Switzerland is, quote, holding the gold for you, and you think the economy collapses, and you say, well, send me my gold, they're going to laugh at you. So I don't quite understand that. I never did. I thought I was missing something.
Well, again, I'm certainly not an advocate of buying gold. But, unless you're doing it as a speculation. You're buying gold because you think the price will go up like you do anything else.
But, like a commodity almost, right?
Yeah, but I would not advocate buying gold.
So let's talk about currency and its place, U.S. currency and its place in the world market, and how that affects the prices that we, and I know it's very complicated, but if you can give us maybe a 2.5-minute tutorial on that.
Oh, yeah, and that's actually something interesting, because I say the dollar, I last noticed against the euro, is up to $1.15. When I was in Austria last summer, it was $1.05. And so what that really means is that when the dollar is weakening like that, then it means that that the U.S. people have less confidence in the U.S. dollar, and it exchange. If you're buying, in other words, if I'm buying something from Austria, I've got to have euros to be able to do it. So I've got to be able to buy euros. Well, if the price of the euro goes up, it means buying anything from abroad becomes more expensive, and buying things from the U.S. becomes cheaper. So that's the way the currency, moderates when there's an imbalance of trade. But it also reflects people's perceptions, because the dollar is also used not just for currency to buy goods other places, but it's also used for investing. And there's a notion that the rest of the world sees the U.S., in particular with what's happening with the Treasury Department, and people buy, the safest investment in the world has always been buying Treasury bonds and notes in the U.S. But people's confidence in the U.S. and the rest of the world seems to be waning because of the wild things that are going on over here. And so their interest in investing in the U.S. seems to be going down, and that's showing up in the value of the dollar.
What are you looking for the next foot to fall? The next thing is an economist. What are you waiting to see the next thing to happen?
Well, again, the question is, to me, is Trump's tariff things really partly a bargaining tool to try to get better deals with the rest of the world? And if that works, and then he backs off on the tariffs, then you can say, he's a genius. I'm not real confident that's going to happen, because I also have heard all his life that he simply thinks that the rest of the world is taking advantage of the U.S. because we import from them more than we export to them. What he doesn't seem to understand is that people want dollars because they want to invest in the United States. And I don't think that's such a bad thing. So
thank you, Doug.
I'm not as worried about this balance of trade deficits as he is.
All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. We'll talk about Pope Francis and his legacy when we come back. 6:30, time now, WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7. The ceremonies continue for the late Pope Francis. Father John Cunningham joins us, Vice President for Mission and Identity at Loyola, a Jesuit priest. Good morning, Father. How are you?
Good morning, fine. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. You know what I wanted to start with, if we can? We hear so much about the difference about him being the first Jesuit priest, first Jesuit pope, rather. Tell me about the Jesuit order and what makes them different, if you would, please.
Yeah, so our founder is St. Ignatius Loyola. He was born in about 1492, so an interesting time in the history of the world with colonialization and the Reformation and the Renaissance all kind of percolating. And basically, he had a conversion. He was hurt in an accident. He was in a battle, actually, and his knee got hit with a cannon. And he had this conversion in bed. He was in his 30s, and he basically said he wanted to be a priest, but he wanted to form a group of priests that were very educated. He wanted a very enlightened priesthood. And so he started this. He had to go to class and learn how to read, believe it or not. He was kind of in the, you know, landed gentry who didn't have, they had readers and writers who would do that for them. He goes off to the University of Paris to study and forms a group of men. There were seven of them, and they come together and they form the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus, and they're approved in 1540. And it's an interesting story. They basically ended up trying to figure out what they were going to do. He wanted to go to the Holy Land and be there, and they wouldn't let him in because of just political things. And so he comes back, and it turns out that they stumble basically into starting a school in Messina, Sicily. And it turned into a phenomenon between 1550 and probably the next 200 years, where they end up having schools all over Europe. And then they end up coming over into the New World. And so Loyola University here in New Orleans is kind of their creation. So it's a different group. So with Pope Francis, you know, if you look at his background, he's kind of interesting. He studied chemistry at one point. Since we're so involved in schools, both high schools and colleges, we're typically encouraged to have another degree in something else other than theology and philosophy. And so he has a chemistry degree. I have a physics degree. So that's basically who we are.
Let me jump in, Father, for a second. So if I were to ask you what makes a Jesuit priest different than other priests, you would tell me?
I'd say two things. I'd say one is the formation is pretty involved. Most of us spend 10 to 15 years in what we call formation, which is basically from the moment you enter the Jesuits and the novitiate till the moment you're ordained, a lot of education and formation involved. And I'd say the second thing that makes us really unique is St. Ignatius Loyola as well had this spiritual, he was a very, you know, his early part of his life, particularly his conversion process, he was a pilgrim and he was wandering and just begging from people. And he sits down and he has this enlightenment where he basically writes what he calls the spiritual exercises, which are a series of prayers basically based on scripture, where you place yourself in there and pray. And we're famous for our 30-day retreat. Each Jesuit does that. We go off for 30 days and pray the exercises. We here in New Orleans have a beautiful place, Manresa House of Retreats, which is out in Convent, Louisiana, which still lives on that legacy of giving these retreats. So there's the two components, I would say, are the education and the formation. And then the second piece is basically the spiritual exercises, the spirituality of basically St. Ignatius Loyola. And I'd add a little third piece in there. You know, we ended up developing into a very super international order. So we're on every continent, maybe not Antarctica, although they've been down there, some of them studying, but we're all over. So that's an interesting aspect to add too. I think Pope Francis comes, as you see, from a very international perspective. He was the son of immigrants who went from Italy to Argentina, and then he has that background. And then he's part of this group of Jesuits that we're all over the, you know, here we are in the U.S., we're in South America, we're in Russia. It's an amazing group.
So when we come back, I'm going to ask you, how did Pope Francis, being a Jesuit, how did that manifest itself during his papacy? But first, I want to ask you, Father Cunningham, what made you choose to be a Jesuit?
You know, I was always a good student. Mm-hmm. I love learning. I ended up before I entered the Jesuits, I ended up getting a PhD in physics. I did some research. I taught a bit. I was always very much interested in education, being a teacher, and also just research stuff too. And I really felt this call to be a priest when it started in high school, and it kind of percolated through college. And then I got to grad school. I thought, I kind of want to take both of these things. I want the priesthood and the background in physics. So the Jesuits were there with open arms. And so I taught physics for 25 years. And here I am at Loyola now as an administrator, but still working in higher education.
What I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that maybe Jesuits are a tad more pragmatic than our other orders?
I don't know if I'd say that. I think pragmatic, I always think of Franciscans as being very pragmatic.
Okay.
They're out there on the, you know, basically, they call them itinerant preachers. They're basically helping people on the street, the living a life of poverty, more of that pilgrim piece that you saw early in Ignatius's life.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say, I think we have always been an order that, I think because of the educational aspect of our formation, we've always been able to adapt to kind of what's going on in the world. And as I said earlier, you know, Ignatius started this, the Jesuits, basically a lot of things are going on, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, all these things are percolating in exploration of the new world. And so the order's always had this, you know, out of necessity, I think, many times, to adapt to current situations.
You know, maybe pragmatic was not the right word, but I think we're saying the same thing differently. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Father John Cunningham, Vice President for Mission Identity at Loyola. He's a Jesuit priest. We'll talk about how being a Jesuit manifested itself in Pope Francis's papacy, and we'll look ahead to who could be the next pope. 651, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 657, 3 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Father John Cunningham, Vice President for Mission and Identity at Loyola, Jesuit priest, about Pope Francis's papacy. Father, I'm going to give you a big question. You can jump in where you feel comfortable, and that is,
sure.
How has Pope Francis being a Jesuit, how has that manifested itself in him being pope? How important was it that we had a Jesuit pope in the Catholic Church and the likelihood of another one? Jump in wherever you feel comfortable on a big, giant
interesting
question.
Yeah, that's a big one. I would say, first, you know, what you see in Pope Francis's papacy, and this is going to be coming up more, particularly when people analyze his preaching homilies, his talks. As I mentioned earlier, you know, a key thing is, for Jesuits is that we pray the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius Loyola. And there's kind of two big components of that. One is a period in the beginning, particularly, of the exercises where you look at your life and consider the sinful sides and things you've done wrong. And in the conclusion of that piece, you come to realize God's mercy, God's loving mercy in your life as you are a person trying to strive to be a good person of faith. His papacy, Pope Francis's papacy, was very much centered on the love of God, particularly God's mercy. And you see that over and over. And I think that just the complications of the world in our 21st century, people are looking for a lot of mercy of God in their lives just because things are so complicated. The second piece of the exercises is really following the life of Jesus from the moment he's born through his ministry, through his death and resurrection, and kind of incorporating that into your life and seeing yourself as being a part of that journey with Jesus and standing sometimes under that cross. I think you really see that in his homilies and his talks, just that idea of a personal God who takes care of us. So I would see those two pieces. And then in regards to the Jesuit now, I think, you know, the papacy's always been sometimes there's members of religious orders. They're already talking about who may be the next pope. One of the candidates they're mentioning is our Cardinal Tobin, who's in Newark, New Jersey. He's a Redemptorist priest. So there's always been kind of a religious group come in. I think in regards to the Jesuit piece, I guess it was time, and he was the best candidate. One of the things I'll say about these conclaves are amazing in that you really see the work of the Holy Spirit, and that what happens is when you may have a disagreement about a particular pope's personality, but you look at the popes over the last several decades, they've been incredible men.
Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly from the movie Step Brothers. I forgot the names exactly in the movie, but either way, they got to stay clear of Mr. Gardocki. Joe Martin joins us now, Terminix owner, to talk about termite season and the swarm. How you doing, Joe?
Hey, Tommy, how are you?
I'm all right.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover. All for just $3, plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code MAN at checkout. That's harrys.com, code MAN. Enjoy!
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not-so-secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Hey, it's me, Paige DeSorbo, and I'm so excited to share my new shoe collection at DSW, filled with my favorite styles and trends for spring. Because if you know me, you know I'm kind of obsessed with shoes. And by kind of obsessed, I mean head over heels. You're going to love these shoes. So snag super cute styles like cute flats, fun heels, and cool sneakers from the Paige DeSorbo collection right now at your DSW store or dsw.com.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Midi Health. At any given time, 61% of adult women say they want to lose weight. But for many, that's easier said than done. If you've had trouble losing weight, don't lose hope. Midi Health uses a deep understanding of women's hormones and a combination of weight loss medications to create a customized plan for each user. Midi Health can help you achieve more effective and sustainable weight loss by addressing hormone imbalances. Midi can also prescribe proven weight loss medications that help you experience reduced appetite and increased feelings of fullness. When paired with hormone optimization, you're not just managing your weight, you're also supporting your body's natural processes, which means you can overcome those weight loss plateaus that in the past have been so difficult to move beyond. So if you're ready to combine the power of hormones with the power of weight loss medications, visit joinmidi.com today. Discover how this innovative approach can lead you to lasting success. That's joinmidi.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hey, thanks for taking the time with us. It's that time of year, isn't it?
It's that time of year, and actually we saw some of our first termite swarms last night. We got a few reports of not heavy termite swarms, but we had some flying termites around some lights, windows, and street lights last night.
What should people do? I always make the analogy every year, and you and I have had this conversation. It's like the Diary of Anne Frank. I sit there with the lights closed, telling the dog not to make a noise. We don't want anybody to know we're here with the lights off rather than everything sealed up. What kind of precautions do you have to take when they're swarming?
Well, first off, we like to say, hey, leave the lights on for at least a moment for you to walk around your house, see where the termites are coming from. Are they coming from a tree near your house? Do you have a mud tube coming from the ground into your house? Do you have mud tubes or swarm castles on your porch? And you may have termites in your wall. So it's a great opportunity just to take a walk around your house and let's see where the termites are coming from, because they show themselves one time a year. So, Tommy, it's like if you had a leak in your roof and it only rained one time a year, we'd probably be in the attic. Hey, where's the leak coming from? Let's find out where the termites are coming from. Some things we can do for termites is there's treatments to protect your house. There's a liquid barrier treatments and there baiting treatments. So those two types of treatments are pretty successful protecting your house against termites, with a liquid treatment being the most thorough and the most protective of a house, because it's like a moat around your house. Termites trail in the ground, they try to get in, and they're blocked.
I tried to do it myself one time, Joe, and I did more damage to the sheetrock than the termites could have ever done, because I thought I saw a kick out. It's not as easy as one would think to determine.
No, and you probably had a hurt back after.
Yeah, well, I just had to get the sheetrock guy in. It was embarrassing. It really was. So if you see a couple of termites in the house after the swarm, do you freak out or not?
No big deal if you see a few. Now, if we start seeing hundreds, 500 termites and over, it may be time to call a professional to come out, take a look, and get an inspection on the house.
What are some of the ways to see spot? I mentioned kick out. I know what that is. But for people that don't know, that would indicate you do have a termite problem.
Yeah, so we say kick out or swarm castle. Really, it's small mud dots on your wall. That's what you would look for. Even as small as a pencil tip, you'll just see a little mud dot on the wall, and that could be a kick out or a hole, or we call it a swarm castle, or something that looks a mud trail or a lump of mud against your house. Poke it with a pencil, poke it with a knife, see if termites come out. That would indicate some termites. And look in your trees for mud tubes, because these Formosa termites love to hang out in trees.
I have been with you guys for years and years and years and years. If somebody wants to get in touch with Terminix, how do they do it?
Give us a call at 504-834-7330 or check us out at TerminixNola.com.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Joe Martin, owner of Terminix, board-certified entomologist. First swarm last night. Oh, boy, it's that time of year. If you've been known to swarm in the French Quarter, we'll talk to Freddie King. We come back, New Orleans City Council member, about garbage pickup and more right now. Time for WWL First News. 744, 16 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Joined by Freddie King, New Orleans City Council member, fellow Shaw graduate, and D.A. Jason Williams made sure he pointed that out the other day. How you doing, Freddie?
I'm doing fine, Tom. How you doing?
I'm all right. Did you hear him or not?
I did not hear him,
He made that distinction. He wanted to make sure that we got that out there. Let's talk about this trash contract. Now, I had Sidney Torres on yesterday. Tomorrow, I'm going to have Troy Henry on to present his side of this. I want you to tell me, you're the councilman for this district, what is going on with this trash contract?
Well, Tommy, the mayor decided to cancel or to notify Mr. Torres and Ivy Waste that she plans on canceling his contract in the next 90 or so days, and that the contract is going to be given to Troy Henry, who was awarded the contract, or who won the bid process back in the fourth quarter of last year.
All right, so how did Sidney Torres get the contract if Troy Henry won it? I'm trying to tell a story in a linear fashion here.
Sure. So Mr. Henry won a contract. However, he and his DBE, his subcontractor, Alvin Richards with Richards Disposal, could not agree to some terms of their contract. And we needed a sanitation provider for the French Quarter for the new year, because the previous company contract had expired. So at this time, we had nobody picking up trash. An emergency contract went out. Sidney Torres, Ivy Waste, was awarded that contract. And he started late December, early January, and has done a remarkable job keeping the quarter clean through Super Bowl, through Mardi Gras, through Sugar Bowl, French Quarter Fest, you name it.
So what happened Was there an interim where the French Quarter was not getting cleaned after Henry got the contract, and it was an emergency thing to get Torres? Tell me what happened.
No, it was a – so once we realized as a council that the contract – that there was a dispute between Richards and his partner, we moved or I should say the sanitation's department moved to have a new – to have an emergency contract. The emergency contract was bid on, so there was never a gap between the last contract and – That expired in December, and Sidney Torres stepping up. There was never a gap.
So what is the situation now with the way Sidney Torres and Waste IV is performing their contract, and what's the quarter like on a daily basis?
Oh, Tommy, the quarter is great. I am frequently in a quarter. Mm-hmm. I visit at least once a week. It smells great. It looks great. I hear from residents, from business owners, from visitors who are saying this is the best we've seen the quarter in quite some time. And I want to say, just make it very, very clear to the listeners, this decision was not made by me or members of the council. This was a decision made solely by the mayor and her advisors. I was never consulted. From what I'm being told, the residents of the quarter, the business of the quarter, the French Quarter Management District, they were never consulted. This was a unilateral decision made by the mayor and her people alone. And I think that's kind of a dangerous way of doing things. You always want to get as much information that you can get from those mostly affected. And in this case, that was just not done.
So do you know if the beef between, I don't know if that's the right word to use or not, but whatever the problem was between Troy Henry and the winning bidder and the subcontractor has been worked out, or what it's going to look like after?
Yes, I was told it's been worked out, and that's fine. And my position is, hey, you had a chance, and this is Freddie King speaking, you had a chance to start working. You couldn't. We had to move on to keep the French Quarter clean. The person that came in, they did a great job, and they're doing such a great job. I don't believe we should take that contract from them. They are pressure washing the streets 7 days a week when a contract requires to be done three times a week. They're hand wiping the trash cans. They're scraping gum off the street. They're doing everything above and beyond. They raised the bar so high. I think it would be a bad move to say, let's go with someone else, when what we have, this known, proven commodity, is knocking it out the park. I think we need to keep things as it is, let the contract play out, and move from there.
So what does the law say, Freddie? I know you're an attorney, because if you got the request for proposals that goes out, and I used to be at one point when I quit school in UNO and went to the University of Life, I was a purchasing agent, so I know a little bit about these RFPs and how they have to They have to spell out exactly what needs to be done. Sometimes a vendor will help you write the proposal because you don't really know what it is that you're talking about. And that's not any kind of collusion or anything. It's just that they know a lot more about it than you do. Sometimes it can be done. It can be manipulated where the RFP is such that there's only one vendor that can provide that service. But we could take a break. We'll pick it up on the other side of this because I'm wondering about the legal part of this. If the RFP said one thing and Sidney Torres raised the bar and went above and beyond that, it would seem as though the right thing to do or the best thing to do in the interest of the French Quarter and the citizens would be to stick with Sidney Torres. However, that may not be the legal thing. And then also, is there any way you can hold Troy Henry's company to the same standard as Sidney Torres is doing right now if that's not what the original RFP called for? We'll pick it up. We come back with Freddie King, 750, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 756 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Freddie King, New Orleans City Council member, talking about the Sidney Torres, IV Waste, Troy Henry, dust up with the French Quarter cleaning contracts. Freddie, I was talking about before the break with the request for proposals with Sidney Torres really over-delivering on what it is that he had to do, right, that it was called for in a contract or not?
Yes, that's what we're doing. Like I said, pressure washing the streets 7 days a week when it's required to do it 3 days a week, wiping the trash cans, scraping the gum off the street, doing a lemon fresh stint. really going above and beyond what the contract required, and that's what's needed. It's that level of service that's needed to keep the French Quarter, which is the economic engine for the city and the state. To keep it going, you need that level of service.
So when it comes to legalities of what the mayor decided to do, I guess it comes down to, did Mr. Henry default originally on the bid or on the contract when he wasn't able to deliver, and then next year it would be time for him to do this again? Or take me through the process, the legal process of this.
Well, I don't want to speculate too much on legal process and give false information. We mm-hmm. will have a council meeting tomorrow. We will go in executive session and hear from our legal team to find out exactly where we stand, what can be done, what should be done. We will, myself and Councilmember Morrell, will have a joint governmental affairs and community development meeting on Monday to allow the community to weigh in, to get their side of it. Tommy, I want to say something. You said something last week, and I heard you. You said type 1 error. It made me research what a type 1 error is, and this is exactly a type 1 error. That's when you say something needs to be changed. It doesn't need to be changed, but in trying to change it, you waste time, you waste mm-hmm. money, and you waste resources. That's what's happening here. This contract does not need to be changed. Everyone, I haven't received one person saying change this. But it's being changed, and as a result, we're wasting time, wasting money, wasting resources, and it shouldn't be. So my final comment is keep the contract as it is, listen to the people, listen to the businesses, and don't change anything.
Moving forward, would it be better to make the RFP require what Sidney Torres is doing now? If you want the contract, you're going to have
absolutely.
To wipe down the garbage cans?
Absolutely. The level has been raised. We see what works. Whoever gets this contract moving forward, the RFP should say everything that's being done now needs to stay in place to keep the quarter immaculate as it is right now.
Thank you, Freddie. Appreciate your time as always. Freddie King, New Orleans City Council member. We'll take a break. Come back, talk to Ronald Surpass about crime. Then we're going to talk to an assistant professor at the LSU School of Kinesiology about Ryan Ramczyk retiring, knee injuries, and pro athletes and injuries and more. So stay tuned. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us. Back in a flash, WWL. 8:15 now, Wednesday morning. That's when we usually talk to Ronald Surpass, professor of practice in the Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Nashville City Police, Washington State Police. You see him on networks when they want to get somebody on and talk about law enforcement. He's a noted expert. How you doing, Chief?
Tommy, it's a great day. I hope you're having a good day.
I am. Let's talk about, before we get to crime in the city and so forth, this thing that happened in LaPlace, and I saw Sheriff Traeg talking about it with 15-year-old, one of them arrested. They show up at 2 a.m. outside of a Waffle House and just go crazy with guns, shooting all over the place. Amazing nobody was killed or injured. What does that say about the availability of guns, about juveniles? Tell me what you take away from that.
I think the first thing is that Sheriff Traeg is an amazing law enforcement leader for our region. I've known him for a few years. I respect him and think he's doing a wonderful job. Secondly, mm-hmm. you have to ask yourself a question. When a 15-year-old looks to their mom and them and says, it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm walking out to go start my day. Mm-hmm. That's one of the key issues to the problem. Gun availability is a two-part thing. There's always a question of whether or not a homeowner is making a gun safe in their home, but that's only half the equation. Kids, young people can find guns on the street as well as anywhere else. So the third issue there is what motivates 15-year-olds or more than one 15-year-old to consider that the use of gun into a place where people are just having their own evening. Maybe they had a target in there, but that's the whole problem we've talked about before, is that some level of disassociation of consequences through a lot of talk that it's never really the child's fault. It's an oppressive something. It's a systemic something. Whether that's true or not doesn't make a difference. If they decide to shoot a weapon into a crowd, even if a victim they're looking for is in there, other people get hurt and killed. So there's no place for them to stand, I think. You decided to do this. You're 15 years old. You have to pay a consequence for it.
I guess what I was wondering is, you know, you see a 15-year-old like that, at what point do you have to get them before they pick up the gun? And I mean, I just can't imagine myself at 15 years of age go into a Waffle House and start firing a gun like crazy. And I just wonder, at what age do studies show that you got to get them on the right track? And if not, then it's too late? Or is there such a thing?
As a general question, juvenile delinquency occurs in most children's life, and it's like bumping up against things. I shoplifted a magazine, or I stole something, or I got in a fight at school, et cetera. They tend to end really, really quickly when a lot of systems around that child kick in, family, friends, expectations, schools. What happens, at least to me, a bit academic and a bit pragmatic, is when you see those systems that are there for thousands of children in depressed areas kick in to save those children from delinquency, you'll also see the ones where in the exact same neighborhood, the exact same conditions, kids who aren't doing bad things have systems to protect them, families, et cetera. And the ones who are not being protected by those systems, they end up becoming delinquent and usually stay in through delinquency until the early 20s.
And the other part of the question I want to ask you, not as it relates to this individual, because I don't think you know this individual or anything about him, but you got a 15-year-old, and Sheriff Trey quoted as saying, I think some of the charges, one of them arrested, 15-year-old arrested, booked with illegal possession of a handgun by a juvenile, illegal use of weapons. They also have some they're looking for, criminal history of the suspects, including charges for murder. How do you rehabilitate somebody like that? Or is that person going to jail for the rest of their life and there's nothing else we can do about it?
Well, I think we all hope that everyone can be saved. And sometimes they can be. And there's just no question about it. There's wonderful stories of young people who went down very bad paths. And by the mid-20s, early 30s, they got released from prison because they were held accountable. And they've gone on to change their lives forever. But then there are always going to be these people that no matter what you think you can do as a society, no matter what you think you can do as a conscious race, religious consciousness, it doesn't matter. The child is just not going to take those cues and they're not going to change their behavior. I think the good news is this. If you look at any community, there's tens of thousands of children who live in the exact same impoverished condition that the child who commits the crime uses to blame for why they committed the crime, yet there's 10,000 other ones in the same conditions who never chose to commit a crime. I think the easiest explanation there is family and support networks.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back and we'll talk about mayoral candidates and what people of New Orleans should be looking for as they decide and vet candidates for mayor and in terms of a crime plan. Also, I'm going to talk to Larry Barabino later on, CEO of Nord. I want to talk to you about the importance of Nord. I know at one point in the 50s, other cities in the country were looking at Nord as an ideal model of how to keep people out of trouble, young people out of trouble, and just how important that is. We're talking to Ronald Surpan.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run, the official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run Finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
We get the best start to the day because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
It's our friend, Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD Superintendent, 820 Traffic Now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Ronald Surpass, Professor of Practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD Superintendent, and a noted authority when it comes to law enforcement. Chief, before we get to things that voters should look for from mayoral candidates, let me talk to you about the importance of Nord, because I'm going to talk to Larry Barabino later. He's come under some criticism for the facilities. How important is a functioning Nord when it comes to keeping kids out of trouble?
Well, I think it's crucial. I played Nord football for 3 years when I was a boy. Mm-hmm. Nord provides a safe space. Nord provides, if you're playing a sport, thinking about learning the basics of life. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. You don't throw a bat at another kid because you missed the ball. I mean, Nord has so many things beyond the athleticism. It's like just how to become part of a society. It helps parents. Obviously, some parents just can't get there, and it's not meant to be an aftercare specialty, but it's a great place for kids to be safe and healthy and hopeful. the Morial administration, when I was a deputy chief, invested a ton of money in Nord, and I would think Richard Pennington, rest his soul, and certainly myself as the number two chief, would assign a significant percentage of the reduction of juvenile-related misconduct and delinquency because there was an aggressive Nord program. Cities got to fund it. They got to make it funded in a real way where parents can see there's an investment, and you'll draw a lot of parents to it. You're not going to get every kid that wants to be bad, but you're going to get a lot of kids who want to be good.
I know you've been here a while, but maybe not that long, but back in the 50s, New Orleans kind of set the standard for youth participation programs. Are they not recreation departments?
I would believe that, because by the time I hit it in the 1970s, it was robust. There was as many Nord playgrounds around the city as there is churches. I mean, they were everywhere, and I played right next to St. Gabriel in Gentilly. I mean, it was just a wonderful place for kids to have a chance to be a kid. And then think about this other thing. You have parents who begin to meet other people from other neighborhoods, mm-hmm. the other communications. They start creating relationships. That's part of a mayor's crime-fighting plan, the non-police stuff that makes a difference, Nord, mental health, child and youth engagement on the bubble of delinquency. Being able to see those issues as part of the crime-fighting plan is important, as is the police department.
Like me, I'm guessing you may have skipped lunch to make that 120-pound team weigh in?
I did.
Did that, jogged around the Berman gym, lose a couple of pounds just so I can make the weigh-in right. for the game. Let's talk about mayoral candidates and what people should look for. How do you separate the BS from what really makes sense when it comes to mayoral candidates and crime plans?
First off, what makes sense is a multifaceted government approach. That's not BS, but it starts to get people confused and not interested in it. But you got to be clear that you see crime as something more than just a police department, because if police departments and mayors could stop all murders, how many would we have? Mm-hmm. None. So you have to think broadly, and I think they'll all have some platforms like that. For me, the key burning issue continues to be the same. The New Orleans Police Department is physically structured with buildings for 1,600 people. We haven't been 1,600 people since 2011. Mm. The New Orleans Police Department continues to build itself as if it's going to reach 1,200 people again, but gets the opportunity to celebrate success in crime reduction at 900. That sends a confusing message to a public. So my answer is this. I think mayoral candidates ought to be very clear that they're going to bring in outside experts, not me, outside experts who know how to do baseline staffing studies to know, do we need 900 or do we need 1,200? And give people a real goal, as opposed to telling these young men and women they come to work every day, it's in the culture, Tommy, we're 400 short, it's a bad day. That's terrible for morale of the officers and terrible for morale of the community. And then the piece that goes with that, we all watch Detroit shut down the number of precinct stations. Those things are expensive. Do we still need 8? Those are the kind of real nut and bolt questions I think they ought to have a plan to address.
I know you're still connected and you got friends. What are you hearing about Nord? What are they telling you?
I have not heard much about Nord, but I know one thing. During a mayoral campaign, if somebody wants to take the bold strokes of action that Mark Morial did 30 years ago in Nord, they would be doing themselves a favor.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time as always and your insight. Ronald Surpass, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent. We come back, we'll talk to our friend Xavier Thompson, Dr. Thompson, assistant professor at the LSU School of Kinesiology, leading expert in sports medicine. We'll talk about Ryan Ramczyk retiring, Saints offensive lineman, because of a chronic knee injury. We'll talk about some other things, injuries in general. Right now, 8:30, time for WWL First News. 8:46, 14 till 9. I always like to have the information in front of me as we talk about anything so I can reference it. And I got to tell you, the search for Ryan Ramczyk's name, it was an adventure trying to figure out how to spell it. It's 8:46, 14 till 9. I'm Tommy Tucker, joined by Dr. Xavier Thompson, an assistant professor at the LSU School of Kinesiology, leading expert in sports medicine. We always enjoy our conversations with him. How you doing, doctor?
Good. How are you, Tommy?
I'm all right. So let's talk about Ryan Ramczyk, 31 years old, and what was it that led to him retiring on April 22nd? Because it seems like this young man at only 31, which seems long in the tooth for an NFL player in a school of life, is just a baby. What was he facing, the knee challenges? And it seems as though he was thinking more about the rest of his life than his football career.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. 31 in most terms is pretty young. And it seems like, you know, years of just degenerative changes in the cartilage. There's not much publicly out about the types of surgery yet, but generally we all have cartilage in our knee and, I mean, throughout our body. But in the knee specifically, we see that it's kind of, once it's gone, it's gone, and there are some potential solutions. But, you know, from everything I've seen, you tried a few different surgical options, and none of them are great. You know, we can try our best to replace what's already there, but we don't really get back the original cartilage.
Why have they not been able to develop a synthetic cartilage yet? You would think in this day and age that'd be the easiest thing in the world, but it's not, is it?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I think part of the problem is there's a few different types of cartilage. We have the type in our ear, and that's not really what we're talking about. And then within our knee, we have the smooth cartilage that kind of helps line the joint, and then we have a tougher cartilage that's our meniscus. And the issue is when we get rid of that smooth cartilage, we try to replace it with either the tough cartilage, which, you know, is great for absorbing shock, but it's not as smooth, so it doesn't really take away the pain. And when we try to replace it with other smooth cartilage, there are newer options, but it takes so long for those to take hold. So even if you replace it perfectly, we don't get great blood supply to cartilage in general, and that's why it doesn't heal the same way as our muscles or our tendons.
So they can't, there's no synthetic that, you know, because I tried, look, Doc, before I had the knees replaced, I tried all of this, I think Synvisc or whatever the name of it is, or the lubricant that they put in there to try to, and none of that worked at all. And I'm just wondering, why can't they make it out of rubber or latex or something like that? Your body rejects it, or what, you can't attach it? What's the deal there?
A little bit of both. So usually what we go to is, if they're young enough, and when I say young enough, I mean, you know, children, we'll try maybe to take it from somewhere else, but that's only good for small patches. The properties are so unique that it's almost, I mean, it's very hard to replace cartilage with anything else. Ligaments are a little bit more straightforward, and even those we have a little bit of trouble with. But cartilage, the issue is we need it to do a lot of things. It's kind of like a sponge. So we want it to absorb a little bit of load. If we don't load it at all, it's not a good thing. It gets weaker. But if we give it too much, it's also not good. And because it has so many jobs, we don't have a great way of replacing it with something completely artificial. And we move to some techniques that use cadavers. So, you know, you take someone else's cartilage, but it takes so long for those to heal. And even with that, with any type of external tissue, you have a risk of rejection that's fairly high, whether it's something man-made or just existed from someone who was not you.
Are they making inroads into replacement cartilage, or are they at least showing progress?
Yes. Yeah, there's definitely been progress. So I think way back when, and when I say way back, I mean even just the early 2000s, we didn't even have some of the techniques we have now. So back then, we were really focused on just replacing with fibrocartilage. And that's what that surgery, you may have heard of microfracture, where essentially we try to drill holes in people's knee, create a blood supply, and that actually, the outcomes were way worse, believe it or not.
Right, let me tell you.
The healing takes a long time. Go ahead.
No, finish your thought, please, and then we'll take a break.
Yeah. Yeah, the healing takes a long time. Now we're getting closer with techniques that use, you know, our other cartilage or cartilage from cadavers. The issue is that works pretty well for people who aren't playing NFL football. They just go through such extreme forces in such a short amount of time that, you know, if he had maybe 2 years to just go live his life, that would be a better outcome than, you know, go out there and block a defensive lineman.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I want to talk to you, Xavier Thompson, our guest, associate professor at the LSU School of Kinesiology, leading expert in sports medicine. By the way, if you weekend warriors have any questions, 504-260-1870, I'd love to pass them along. And while Dr. Thompson can't diagnose you individually, I mean, he's not seeing you or touching you or anything like that, but he can maybe give you some general information. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Text, message, and data rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. I'll pass the questions along. I want to talk when we come back, too, about proclivity to injury, and is there any way you can kind of look the way a guy's built and say, well, maybe he's more inclined to injury than the other? Because somebody told me Zion Williamson maybe didn't have the frame to be durable when it comes to basketball. Does the same thing apply to football? A lot of questions. We'll get the answers when we come back. 852, 8 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:58, couple of minutes left with Xavier Thompson, assistant professor at the LSU School of Kinesiology, leading expert in sports medicine. Doc, you know, I'm looking at this NFL combine thing. You got unless you're a quarterback or a wide receiver, you see how many times you can bench press 225. I understand that. That's not going to help you if your knees aren't there, though. And I'm just wondering, is there any way to determine what, if players are more predisposed to knee injuries or not due to the way they're built or constructed, or is it just the luck of the draw and what happens during the play?
It's really a combination of both. And so a lot of what happens that doesn't make it to TV at the combine is there's a lot of medical evaluation behind the scenes, a lot of talking to previous medical staff at the colleges these guys have played at to see if they've been hurt before. But even once they get to the NFL, we have gotten such a long way in sports medicine and sports science. We can observe, you know, exactly how they move, and not just, you know, a TV. I'm talking, you know, lab setups and just looking at how the joints move. And the issue is when you get to that level, you've probably been moving in a certain way for such a long time that it gets really hard to change some of those patterns, even if they do make you more predisposed to injury.
Yeah, I know from being at the Super Bowl convention center, whenever you see the NFL players, all of them walking with limps here, there, the other thing. Did just about every player other than a kicker have some kind of knee injury if you're going to play in the NFL, Doc?
Not necessarily knee injury, but yeah. Some type of musculoskeletal injury. And I remember freshman in college, one of the first conversations the professor had with me is, you know, at a Division I level, anyone who is playing is hurt.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate it. 9:09, making our way through Wednesday morning, which also happens to be NFL Draft Eve, and we're joined by Mike Haas, our friend and the voice of the Saints. How you doing, Mike?
I am well. Yeah, Draft Eve. I like that.
Yeah.
So we should get to open one draft pick tonight, right? We get one before, you know.
That's right. One of them, a small one, a late round pick.
That's
you can
right.
only
nothing
open
big,
one.
Something out of the stocking.
Yes. Just so we can sleep. Real quick, I wanted to acknowledge it. Mike Patrick passed away at 80 years old, and he was a voice of ESPN, Sunday Night Football with Joe Theismann and Al McGuire. Tell me, Mike, you know, you're a play-by-play guy in the NFL. You only got 32 of those jobs, right? 32 teams in the NFL?
Yep.
I had a rough night. Anyway, who did you admire growing up, like play-by-play? Who were some of the guys that really got your attention?
I tell you what, I'm not saying this, but Mike Patrick, when I grew up, first off, you know, when I was little, there was no ESPN, wasn't all this stuff. So you would get, I grew up in Virginia, so ACC basketball, you would get ACC basketball on like Tuesday or Wednesday and Saturday. And Mike Patrick would do a lot of the games, Maryland basketball. And so he was a voice that I kind of grew up with, but typically if I had to pick, it would be more Jim Nantz, because he can do it all, right? I mean, the guy can go from the Final Four to the Masters and, you know, and flip the switch, and he's just a super guy. So there's a lot out there, but to those two, to me, and I didn't know about Mike Patrick, you know, that's tough. But he was a very early voice in my childhood.
You mentioned Jim Nantz. I know you're a golfer. You played golf in college. I presume you watched the Masters. At the end of the Masters, for nearly 7 minutes after Rory sank that putt, and of course he could be teeing off tomorrow, defending his title at the Zurich Classic. I want to get that out there. They said 46 words in 7 minutes. That's all they said, 46 words in 7 minutes, and let the picture tell a story. And that's an important part of broadcasting, is it not?
Brilliant. Go back to the Steve Gleason punt, block punt, right? I mean, it's the hardest thing. Probably you want to say something that will be legendary, but the smartest thing is to not say, and especially with Rory and especially with the block punt. I mean, I was flying back from Virginia, So I was kind of watching the end of the Masters online, no video. So on Masters.com, you could see the ball go up, and it either went in or out. And I know there were two women from Baton Rouge wondering, why is this guy crying to my right when I found out that Rory had won and saw it for the first time? They're like, what is this guy doing? But that's, you know, Nance is you know, that's what you do. Sometimes the best thing is to shut up.
If you saw it live, you had a lump in your throat, I'm telling you. Let's talk about the Saints and the draft tomorrow, Mike. Tim tells me that, you know, Vegas puts out odds on the Saints drafting Shedeur Sanders, and for a while they were the favorite. Now the money's moved away. I don't put any stock in that because they've been trying to balance a book. First of all, it's a math game. They're trying to get people to bet on this, bet on that, bet on the other thing. Let's talk about the Derek Carr situation first, and then from there we'll move on to draft choices.
Okay. I found out April 11th. I was Friday in Virginia. Thought it was fake news initially. I was like, what? And I don't know a ton more today than I knew on April 11th. Only that, and this is not just me, this is across the board, nobody seems to understand the play, right? If it's a trade me kind of thing, it's a unique angle to take, shoulder surgery. If it's, you know, it doesn't, he's going to get, this doesn't help the Saints. The Saints are going to, you know, they're $59 million dead cap next year. They've already paid him this year. I mean, it's not a financial savings. It's just the timing of it. Mickey's talking today at 12. And so hopefully we will get some knowledge about it. We have not heard a lot. It's just the whole thing seems kind of weird. It's kind of not really in the DNA of what we kind of thought about Derek Carr. He didn't, I'm thinking his world, feel the love that he wanted from the new staff. And it wasn't bad, but it wasn't, you know, by the owners' meetings, it was kind of like you felt he was the guy. So let's put it this way. I've been asked so many times about it since April 11th. I feel like I'm changing my story just to kind of make it different now. I don't know. I don't get it.
Because you, what I don't understand, and this, I guess, is what you're saying, the injury would have to go back to either last year that we didn't know about or occur in between. And if it occurred in between, how did it occur, right? Is it that simple?
I think it was I've heard two. Well, the version I heard is that he had it in 23, never really got addressed, and he kind of played through it. I mean, he got hurt three times in 23 in the second half of games and first half. And I, in my, you know, humble, no medical school opinion, feel like he did maybe kind of tweak it a little bit in that Giants leap. Maybe not. Maybe, you know, I know it was more of a hand. You know, either way, we feel like the Saints knew to some degree about it. I don't know to what degree. Apparently he wasn't throwing in March. So I don't, you know, it's been a mystery. But you talk about changing the kind of complexion and the focus of the draft, that move on Friday, you know, put the Saints, you know, into a position of people wanting to know what in the world they're going to do. Now, your next question is going to be, well, all right, so what do they do with nine? All we know, all I can tell you is this franchise, their grade is their grade, right? Who they had and who's on their board is their grade. I don't see them going on Friday, April 11th. All right, that's it. Let's open up the books again. Let's see what we're going to do. I don't see it because I believe, and many people do, they have some options, not to mention they have many needs. And, you know, it's not, I hate to use the word, in their DNA to trade back, but this is the most opportune time possibly to do so and get a quarterback maybe at 18 or later, where then, okay, you know, he's worthy of there, but not nine.
When it comes to the timing of all of this, just as a fan, okay, because you know so much more than I do about this, but as a fan, I'm thinking, right, well, so you use this opportunity to see what Spencer Rattler can do for you. And then next year, quarterback's class is going to be a lot better, so maybe it times out that way. What do you think?
I think they're going to get a quarterback in this draft.
Okay.
Give me
some names.
I think they like Jackson. I think they like Jackson, not necessarily more than the others, or more than Shador, mm-hmm. but I think they like Jackson Dart. I feel like they've put a lot of time into that. You hear a lot about Tyler Shuck. There's going to be some guys available. Quinn Ewers, they spent some time with. But I think based on fit of the offense, fit of the coach, if I had to say that what quarterback they will end up with in this draft, it would be Jackson Dart. Now, here's the other thing that I don't – maybe this is not – it's not new, but let's say the kind of cheapest players – not cheapest, but, you're going to be $59 million dead cap money for Derek Carr next year, $59 million. So the rookies guys, they come in on a rookie contract. If for whatever reason you draft a quarterback and it doesn't work and you have a bad season again and you're up drafting again high in 26, you get another one.
Mm-hmm.
It's not costing you an arm and a leg. Keep doing it until you get it right.
Do you have any besides Jackson Dart? And you're not talking about in the first round here. You're talking about he would be around.
I don't think the problem is, you can't wait around. You start, you have Pittsburgh at 21, and then you feel like Cleveland and the Giants, who both need quarterbacks but aren't going to take him probably at 2 and 3, are going to work their way back into the first round. Or they pick, prior to the Saints in the second round. So I don't know if you can wait around too long, because, that means both Jackson and Shador possibly could be gone. Now, if you're set on, Quinn Ewers or Shuck or Jalen Milroe, then you're okay. So I feel like, and because they've got some draft capital that we've never had before. Mm-hmm. I should say never, that's not right. But with 6 picks in the top 130, a first, a second, 2 threes and 2 fours, man, that's some capital to move around in this draft. But they have so many needs. Eventually you're going to ask who they're going to pick at 9. I do not think it's going to be a quarterback. My thought would be trade back with maybe like Seattle, mm-hmm. and get Jackson. But if not, if you stay at 9, my pick would be Tet McMillan, the wide receiver.
Wait, when you say trade back, I'm trying to keep my directions, the arrows going here. With Seattle, you would
from 9 move Seattle into 9. You go to 18 and take Jackson Dart. That keeps you ahead of Pittsburgh at 21 and ahead of Cleveland and the Giants, who, if they don't work back into round 1, which may be somewhat unlikely, they're the first 2 picks of round 2. So you if that's your guy.
And you get Jackson Dart and something else, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the one thing we don't know. You'll get something else in that trade.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. We know the quarterbacks and how they're kind of listed. We don't know the Saints grade on them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We can look at who they visited for draft days and pro days and who went and how many people, but it's where they are on the board. I just don't think the Saints are going to change their board because Derek Carr's shoulder announcement on the 11th.
All right, let me take a break. You hear the orchestra. We'll take a break. We come back. Talking to Mike Haas, voice of the Saints. It's draft eve. Of course, I'll outline our coverage for you. It's big at the 504. You bringing your clubs, Mike, or not?
They're in the back of the car, baby.
All right, there you go. He's going to be at 504 Golf tomorrow with our draft coverage. And I want to see that Mike Haas swing. I know he played college golf. Anyway, here's your chance to win a pair of tickets to the second weekend of Jazz Fest. Today's password is souvenir. All you have to do is go to WWL.com/contests, enter that word of the day, souvenir, and you'll have a chance to win tickets to see amazing artists like Pearl Jam, Luke Combs, Lenny Kravitz, Santana, Patti LaBelle, Trombone, Shorty, and more. We'll have a word for you every day at 9, noon, 3, and 6. Second weekend of Jazz Fest. Go to WWL.com/contest and enter souvenir. Good luck. Happy festing from Miller Lite, the official beer of Jazz Fest and WWL. Tommy Tucker, more with Mike Haas in the draft when we come back on WWL. 9:28, draft eve tomorrow at 4 o'clock. Our coverage starts. Deuce McAllister, Mike Haas in the Saints draft preview show. And Mike, to be clear, y'all are going to be at 5:04 at 4 o'clock?
No. We're going to be at
the Saints facility.
Saints camp. That's this what is we roll through Mike Parent in Ireland, the defensive coordinator, Mickey Loomis, Kellen Moore. I mean, it is just 2 hours of interviews, exclusive interviews with all these new coaches, and Mickey and Kellen, Jeff Ireland. So now we're at Saints camp, and then we roll out to the 5:04.
All right, so put yourself, you know Mickey Loomis, you know of Kellen Moore, and you know what he's all about, his history. I'm just trying to think, Jeff Ireland, you know him a long time. Put all of this together and come up with one strategy for the draft and for next year, and how does this all play out? How do you see this? You understand what I'm saying? Because everybody's got a hand in, everybody's got a voice, but Kellen Moore's got a vision. That's why they hired him.
Yeah, that's the tricky part, right? Because the room itself has not changed greatly. But for the first time, you know, when you had Sean for a long time, then you had Dennis, who was your defensive coordinator, then head coach, right? And so you've had you've got a stable of people in there, front office, who've been there for a long time. And then you have a lot of new coaches, new DC, new OC. So I think it'll be that the dynamic of the room is what we don't know. Mm-hmm. Nothing changed a lot in the off season as to a philosophical, you know, it was about restructuring contracts, getting under the cap, which they did still. Well under the cap, have some room to do some things. So that kind of philosophy didn't change, which of course means you gotta pay your taxes at some point. Mm-hmm. But you know, they are able to have 9 players to possibly draft. I think that is, and if they for some reason draft back, now I say that, we'll see. You look at the last 5 drafts, the Saints have drafted 29 players, and Tampa and Atlanta and Carolina have drafted 37 and 36, right? And 4 or 5 in the top 10. The Saints, none in the top 10. Mm. So, you know, the Saints average about 6 players a draft. The other teams have drafted really a whole full draft more. And so I think it's time to get some, because you need so much, I shouldn't say so much help. I think there's ability with 9 picks, if not more, to really help this team. And I didn't 4 or 5. They had 3 fifth-round picks last year. You had 1, 2, then 3, 5. Mm-hmm. Now you got 4 in the 3rd and 4th. Man, that's a whole different ball game. So I think these picks got to be used. Don't, you know, not trade them away. And I think they got to be used to the maximum impact. The 2023 class and the 2024 class, it's too early to tell. But they, you know, I think anybody would say that, you know, they'd like to see more out of some of those 2 classes, but it's too early. Mickey says you need 3-4 years where you really start judging a draft class. But this draft class needs to be 2017, needs mm-hmm. to be 2006.
So with that being said, with the needs that they have and the players that are available, I'm not asking you to go through a whole mock draft, but how do you see this playing out? First of all, the one thing I think what I'm hearing you say is Saints doing something crazy is off the table. That's not going to happen.
I don't think so. The only thing that you could do to be crazy would be to somehow have tried to get up into the one spot. And, you know, I heard maybe they made some calls, but that wasn't happening. So, no, I don't think there'll be anything just completely out of whack because of the way the draft is. So the Saints have struggled stopping the run and running the football. This is a pretty good draft from a tight end standpoint, from especially a defensive line standpoint, running back, offensive line. It's, you know, those guys, you can't have enough. So to me, once we get kind of past these first couple of picks, I think you're going to see some trench people and, you know, you just look around where they need help. Cornerback, safety, tight end, offensive line. I think you need another wide receiver. That's why I feel like they're going to, you know, you have a unique opportunity. If things go kind of the way I anticipate, you are going to have, if ninth pick, the chance to pick the top tight end, maybe, mm-hmm. the top on the board wide receiver, maybe, the top on the board linebacker, the top on the board safety. One of the, you're going to get a top guy on the board of a position of generally need, because you have a lot of need. At some point, I don't think it's going to be one or two. They're going to get a running back. Their running back room is, you know, we have just questions. I think Alvin's great. Don't know about Kendre Miller. Clyde Edwards-Helaire, you know, what's his future? So I think it's a good draft for them to have nine picks because of what they need and where they're picking. The question is, do they keep all nine? Right, that's not been what has been. They haven't had nine picks since 2015. So, will they keep all nine? Will they get more? You know, it's possible to get more.
What is?
You're not in a bad situation at nine. If you don't have Shador or Jackson rated as your ninth guy, then I don't think they'll pick one of those two. The question is, how far can you draft back? Here's the thing. I'm going to ask Mickey this today because I'm curious. You know, when you draft up, you gain control. You draft up, you talk to the team, you know what's going to happen. You're going to get your guy. When you move back, there's a little trepidation there. There's just you lose control. You typically maybe not get screwed, but sometimes maybe you do. And it's just that unknown. And so they don't do that. They trade up. They get their guy. But this might be one of those ones, because of the depth of the draft and where it is and what you need, that I would consider it. Draft him back, at least keep a nine, maybe get more.
It's going to be fun to watch it unfold. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate your time, man. I really do. And I hope that you draft somebody whose name is easy to pronounce for you.
Oh, my gosh, thank you. Please do so.
I just thought about that. You know, it can't hurt. Thank you, sir. It's time for the Saints and NFL Draft and WWL Draft Fest. It is a festival of football starting tomorrow at 4 o'clock. Deuce and Mike Haas and the Saints Draft Preview Show. It's appointment listening for any Saints fan. Featuring the Saints top brass from the Saints facility, head coach Kellen Moore, GM Mickey Loomis, offensive coordinator Doug Nussmeier, defensive coordinator Brandon Staley, associate head coach and running backs coach Joel Thomas, plus senior assistant GM and vice president of college personnel Jeff Ireland, vice president of pro personnel Michael Parenton, special teams coordinator Phil Galliano, national scout Terry Wooden, and defensive pass game coordinator and Shaw graduate Terry Joseph. Saints draft preview tomorrow, 4 until 6. That's followed by the Black and Gold Draft Show, presented by Flight by Yingling, the next generation of light beer, live from 504 Golf and Entertainment at 3800 Howard Avenue in New Orleans. It's going to be an exciting show, an exciting draft with the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert, Mike Dettillier, Steve Geller. Also, Deuce Haas and Jeff Nowak will be there. All of it happening on Saints Radio tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday on WWLAMFM.com and the free Odyssey app. Game on. I can't wait for it. Let's take a look at traffic now, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I was flipping around the TV over the weekend, I think it was, and saw something on WYES, A History of Nord or New Orleans in the 50s or something. And Nord, originally the New Orleans Recreation Department Commission, which was shortened to Nord, that was like a national model for juvenile recreation and keeping kids from getting into trouble and so forth. Then it kind of went down, then it went up. Now some groups are saying that joint statement released, and I'm quoting a story from Joni S. here from NOLA.com. Joint statement released by the NOAA Coalition says the state of the New Orleans Recreation Department Commission's neighborhood parks and sports fields is alarming and on Safe for Kids, adding to the criticism the agency has received in recent years. Joining the coalition, which includes nonprofits and businesses, in issuing the public letter are the New Orleans NAACP, New Orleans Chamber of Commerce, MCC, East New Orleans Neighborhood Advisory Commission, Hispanic Chamber of Commerce of Louisiana, and the Business Council of New Orleans and the River Region. Joining us now is Larry Barabino, the CEO of NORD, the New Orleans Recreation Department, to talk about this. How you doing, Larry?
Hey, good morning, Tommy.
Let's talk about, first of all, the importance of NORD. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but I mean, when it comes to the history of it in the city and the importance in deterring juvenile delinquency, there's no doubt that that's the best money you can spend, is there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of the best investments you could spend between recreation, recreational services, and the education school system services. Absolutely.
So what would you say to the report that the New Orleans Coalition that I just quoted and Metropolitan Crime Commission and so forth had to say?
So, well, it's a few layers to that. And just to, you know, be clear is people talk about the newly released Big Green Easy Master Plan report that's out. And just to be clear, NORD, actually in partnership with the Mayor's Office of Youth and Families, wrote a grant to NRPA, received $450,000 to have that master plan done, right? My goal as the CEO of NORD was to be very transparent on the state of not just NORD, but Parks and Recs throughout the city of New Orleans. And I participated intimately with that master planning, but to present that master plan to the administration, as well as the state elected officials and the locally state elected officials and our council, to show the state of NORD compared to Parks and Recs around the region, as well as the country. And it showed that, of course, NORD had facilities. NORD's been in existence since 1947. NOAA have facilities that are in dire need of funding to be repaired, replaced, or demolished, and are restored. But also it showed that we lack funding, lack staff. And so, you know, was not surprised at some of the stuff, because we know that we need to do some major capital investments in NORD's portfolio as it relates to a lot of his properties and facilities.
So let me read another thing here. This is from Laura Canizaro Rodriguez, who I think was on with Newell talking about this. December, she posted saying that it just sends a strong message to our youth that we don't care. There's how we represent our city and our community, saying that the NORD Commission, which operated on a $20 million budget last year, shouldn't receive taxpayer dollars if it continues to neglect its facilities. So I guess the question to you, Larry, is, are you getting the money you need, or are these facilities in a state of disrepair? And this is a big, long question, so bear with me, because you don't have enough money to take care of them. I know you guys are in the middle of an audit right now. What are your main challenges, let's put it that way, when it comes to either prioritizing playgrounds or facilities that need to be looked at? And do you have the money to take care of what needs to be done?
Sure. So with saying that, every year I go in front of council to present my budget. And in the process, I have some council members that, first of all the council members, support NORD. But also they ask me, do I need any additional funding for the programming side? And what I always tell the council is, in actuality, I need funding for the capital side. Because the capital side, which is bond funds, a capital outlay funds, don't come to NORD. They go to the city's capital projects administration that renovates, rebuilds, and or build new facilities, not just for NORD, but all parks and rec agencies. And so with saying that, my budget is designed primarily to fix things at NORD and to operate the facilities and to program those facilities. But with saying that, the biggest need, and it's the fact that the city of New Orleans received millions of dollars from FEMA to rebuild facilities. But what we did not receive is the money to the capital money to continue to maintain and to upkeep facilities that are, some of them are operated 6 to 7 days a week. These facilities are just like our homes. When we go through hurricanes and we go through storms, these facilities go through those same storms and same hurricanes. So if I have 50 playgrounds or facilities with high mass lights, I might have 50 facilities with high mass light damages, right? And so those funds to go out and fix all 50 of those do not sit in my operational budget, and that's why my ask every year is for more bond funds and or more capital outlay funds.
Let me get this text real quick, because I don't know what I don't know, Larry, and I don't know who texted this in. I don't know what it means. $15 million in payroll is mismanagement. Do you know what that means? Do you have $15 million in payroll?
So let me say this, yes. So when you look, first of all, everything with NOAA is transparent. Everything is done through whether it's the procurement department or the administration. Everything is viewed by the city council. So when you talk about payroll or you talk about staffing, right? So NOAA has to bring on an additional 150 staff for summer to open outdoor pools. Mm-hmm. That staffing, NOAA have between about 160 facilities and assets that we manage, and we have over 35 to 40 staff that goes out, clean up, do repairs, maintenance of those facilities. We have 12 to 14 multipurpose rec centers that provides programming throughout the community.
Larry, we're running out of time. Let me get to this. You got a $20 million budget. Is that the deal?
It's a $20 million budget with $1.2 million at CDBG for summer. But, of course, we run so many facilities that those facilities are staffed.
So give me a quick
stadiums or facilities.
Give me a quick pie chart on how that money's spent.
So about $16 million is on staff and personnel to manage all 160-plus facilities and assets citywide, which consist of rec centers, swimming pools, stadiums, outdoors programs, cultural programming, a list of program, educational programming, what is the athletic programming. So there are staff that manage and maintain those programs and those facilities citywide.
So the $4 million that's left out of that $20 million, there's no way that's going to be enough for any capital improvements, and it doesn't seem like it's even enough to maintain what you have in terms of equipment and everything else, is it?
Absolutely, and that's why the request is for bond funds, because bond funds can be used specifically to do capital outlay repairs and to maintain to do the facility repairs and maintenance as needed with the HVAC systems and et cetera. And we're always requesting capital outlay funds.
So the budget to cut grass around playgrounds, et cetera, that comes out of that $20 million, or is that parkways?
That comes out of that $20 million. That's $500,000 goes to grass cutting.
Okay. I want you to come back when we have a little bit more time, because
absolutely.
And especially after the audit comes out, because I want people to understand this. I don't want to accuse you of something wrong if you're not doing it. I don't know where.
Absolutely.
You know, I know you're all about transparency. I think you are. And,
yes.
And you want people to understand where the money's going. So nothing's cheap. I know that. And we'll talk about the different areas and which states are in the most disrepair and needs the most immediate attention. All right. You can come back.
Absolutely. Look forward to it.
All right. I think it's an important thing. Larry Barabino, CEO of NORD New Orleans Recreation Department. It is the best money I think a government can spend to keep kids out of trouble. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got planned for us when we come back on WWL.